Even as we meet this immediate situation, we all recognize that we have to do more to address the root causes of the problem, and that includes poverty and violence in Central America.
Central America, root causes, a wave of migration, and $1.5 billion in new aid over the next couple of years. That's what we're talking about in Latin America Today, the WOLA podcast. Welcome and thank you for tuning in. I'm Adam Isaacson, a senior associate here at WOLA.
And I'm Sarah Kanosian, a program officer.
Back in December, Congress passed a big aid package, mostly for the so-called Northern Triangle countries, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. And here in Washington, policymakers now keep talking about the need to address the root causes of these countries' crisis of violent crime, but we don't often get a good sense of what that means. So we're going to spend this podcast trying to unpack it a bit.
In the summer of 2014, tens of thousands of unaccompanied children from the Northern Triangle countries made big headlines when they showed up at the U.S.-Mexico border, in most cases claiming to be fleeing out-of-control violence. Their numbers dropped sharply by August of that year, and the issue sort of fell off people's radars here in Washington. But in the last several months, the number of unaccompanied children and families has been rising again. At the same time, Congress granted over $750 million in assistance to Central America for 2016, and on February 9th, President Obama requested another $750 million for 2017.
We have countries that are pretty close to us, in which the life chances of children are just far, far worse than they are here. And parents who are frightened or are misinformed about what's possible are willing to take extraordinary risks on behalf of their kids.
In June of 2014, President Obama called the increase in Central American migrants an urgent humanitarian situation. Between that month and last December, we're talking 19 months, the United States and Mexico combined apprehended a stunning 111,678 children from the three Northern Triangle countries alone. Now stop and think about this. These three countries combined have about 30 million people. So in 19 months, one in every 300 Central American citizens was a child traveling alone who is captured along the way. This doesn't even count any kids who weren't caught, nor does it count an even larger number of Central American adults or members of a similar and growing number of families traveling together who were also apprehended or who may have made it. So why are people leaving?
As we interview the children as they come across our border, as they're apprehended by Border Patrol, or really as they turn themselves into Border Patrol, and as others interview children in other countries in the region, it's evident that, like all migration, there are mixed motives here, as I note in my testimony. But an underlying theme is the violence. In fact, if we overlay on maps where many of these children are coming from and where gang violence and drug cartel presence is the strongest, they largely lie one on top of the other.
That was Tom Shannon, counselor to the Secretary of State, speaking at a hearing in June of 2014. As he notes, there are many so-called push factors driving people to leave. These include things like high unemployment and underemployment rates and droughts affecting rural populations. But sky-high murder, crime, and violence rates in all three countries are at the core.
Just to give you an idea of the scope of what we're talking about, El Salvador closed out 2015 with 6,657 murders. That averages out to over 18 murders a day in a country of 6.4 million people. And at 104 murders per 100,000 people, it's the highest murder rate measured for any country outside of a war zone in at least 20 years. By comparison, New York City, with over 8 million people, more than El Salvador, saw only 352 homicides last year, 1/19 as many. Honduras, which previously held the title of world's murder capital, registered 5,047 homicides in 2015. Guatemala's overall rate is considerably less than the others. It's in the low 30s per 100,000. But Guatemala City's is still 47 per 100,000 people. And in the United States, only St. Louis and Baltimore are higher. We talked to Hector Silva about how this violence is affecting migration from the region. An investigative journalist from El Salvador, Hector is an expert on Salvadoran organized crime and served as the deputy chief of mission at the Salvadoran embassy in Washington. He's now a research fellow at American University.
The numbers started to climb up again after a decrease in the summer of 2015 is that migrants and smugglers felt that it was safe again to try B, violence. Violence is a factor determining life in Central America. Urban neighborhoods, I mean, two-thirds of population live under daily constant violence. I mean, violence is not something that's that happens incredible. Sometimes. Violence happens every day at every corner in these cities, in San Salvador, Tegucigalpa, San Pedro Sula. So what people is doing is getting away, getting out.
Why is Central America so violent? First, there's a strong presence of street gangs in all three countries, but particularly in Honduras and El Salvador, where the Mara Salvatrucha, known as the MS-13, and 18th Street gangs battle each other for control over neighborhoods, towns, and local drug markets. These gangs actually originated in U.S. cities, especially in Los Angeles, in the 1980s and 1990s. Some of their members were then deported to Central America. Now, in gang-controlled areas, these groups exert a terrifying amount of control. No one is safe from extortion, not even teachers, who in some cases are forced to pay the gangs from their own pockets just to teach class. People will be killed for anything. Crossing into another gang's territory, even if to get to their job or school, not paying extortion or refusing to join a gang can be a death sentence. For the most part, the gangs aren't the ones moving drugs to the United States. Drug trafficking groups, or transportistas, work with Mexican and Colombian criminal organizations, and they're a factor of violence too. So are sicarios, or assassins for hire. Then you have violence carried out by government security forces, which we'll get into later.
Driving the violence are many factors that these countries have in common. Justice systems that don't work, meaning that there's no deterrence for criminals who are willing to commit crimes. Governments that aren't collecting taxes from their elites, meaning there's no money for security. Corruption that's endemic at all levels, not only among ruling officials, but even among the police forces and the military. On top of this are low economic growth rates, high levels of poverty, and very few employment options. In this environment, crime and violence thrive. All of these factors are now known as the so-called root causes of migration, a phrase that we hear a lot here in Washington. As Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs Roberta Jacobson warned a House committee, there will be more migration if they aren't addressed.
When we look at the migrant crisis of last year, we know we have to get at root causes of violence and root causes of the poverty and lack of opportunity.
William Brownfield, the Assistant Secretary for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement, added to the root causes theme.
We learned lessons. The most important was that the solution to the migration crisis is not at our border. It is in Central America and the root causes that drive the migration north.
At the end of 2014, the Obama administration pledged to help Central America address some of its root causes.
That's why I've made it clear to the leaders of the region that if they're ready to take ownership of this plan, we, the United States, and I predict the international community, will be ready to make significantly greater investments to help you solve each of the problems that you face. That's why the Alliance for Prosperity you put forward is so very important. It recognizes the urgency of the moment.
That's Vice President Joe Biden last year, when the governments of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, along with the Inter-American Development Bank, signed the plan of the Alliance for Prosperity in the Northern Triangle. The plan, first made public in November of 2014, set up a framework to address violence and development challenges. It has a five-year horizon and a $20 billion price tag, 70 to 80% of which the governments say they're going to put up themselves. About a year ago, the White House asked Congress for $1 billion to support the Alliance for Prosperity plan. Some in Washington immediately started calling the package Biden's billion. It was part of the administration's 2016 aid request. In the end, Congress agreed to fund $750 million in 2016, and this week we learned that the president has requested a similar amount for 2017. On top of this will come perhaps $150 million more in military and police aid from the Defense Department.
This is a very big increase over what Central America was getting before, but the region had already received an aid increase that started back in 2008, with root causes and citizens' security part of the goals expressed back then, too. That aid increase was called the Central America Regional Security Initiative, or CARSI. Between 2008 and 2014, U.S. agencies gave more than $800 million for CARSI activities. We estimate that $551 million of this, the majority, went to the region's military and police forces. During this time, the Defense Department also provided about $287 million. A key focus of this U.S. security assistance has been something called vetted units, creating small elite units within other countries' security forces, made up of agents who are thoroughly background checked and often kept separate from the rest of the force. On this, here's our colleague Adriana Beltran, who runs WOLA's citizen security program.
The idea, as they explain it, behind vetted units in terms of capacity building is that you train, you identify a few key officers, mm-hmm. and you train them, and then eventually that trickles down or, you know, permeates through the institution. I have never seen that happen. I have never seen proof that strategy works for strengthening an institution. I have seen examples of where vetted units have become corrupt. No, that's not always the case, but you have cases in Guatemala, you have cases in Honduras where eventually, you know, your good cops end up becoming rotten because the entire institution has a problem of corruption.
Adriana says that CARSI didn't work and Central America got still more violent since 2008 because there was too much focus on tactics like the vetted units and not enough focus on building functioning security and justice institutions.
You know, at least CARSI did, which I think was good, focus on violence prevention. The law enforcement aspect tended to place too much emphasis on training and equipment and not really on addressing the institutional or structural problems within the institutions. So, you know, when you're talking about extremely weak police forces that have been co-opted by organized crime, training 500 cops is not going to make them more accountable or effective. You need to really figure out how do you build the institution from the ground up, or how do you help these countries build the institution from the ground up.
But the 2016 package promised a break from the past. Here's Nita Lowy, the ranking Democrat on the House Appropriations Subcommittee that funds foreign aid.
More must be done to invest in civil society and to provide alternative livelihoods, education, and opportunities for youth. And while I support this effort, I have a number of questions about the policies being proposed. For example, this year's request for the region would scale up long-standing state and USA programs in Central America. Can't help but ask, how will these programs be more effective than in the past? What makes them different?
Congresswoman Lowy's concerns were pretty common in Congress last year. Although in the end, three-quarters of Biden's billion did get funded, neither the House nor the Senate appropriated even that three-quarters at first. Most of the president's request was funding for so-called soft aid, institution building, economic development, community building projects. But many members of Congress wanted to keep the focus on the hard side, border security, more vetted units, more drug interdiction. Here's House Republican Appropriator Mario Diaz-Balart.
My concern is that I don't see that emphasis on security. And I don't disagree with what you've all talked about, that there are other components. But unless people feel secure, and I don't care how much opportunity we give, in whether it's in Honduras or Guatemala, those gangs are still going to go to little girls and take them. Those gangs are still going to go to folks, families, and you know, murder them if they don't join the gangs, etc. So my concern is, and Ambassador, I agree with you, I think CARSI has done some really good things, and that is a long-term proposition. But so my concern is I just don't see in this proposal, frankly, enough emphasis on that security component.
Some members of Congress are not only suspicious of foreign aid in general, but they voice frustration with Central America's particular lack of progress. They pointed to decades of U.S. assistance to the region and sort of said, hey, these efforts have not been working. So the Obama administration heard a lot of suspicion about whether another $1 billion might do anything. WOLA Program Director Jeff Thale summarized some of these congressional concerns.
The Congress is pretty tired of throwing good money after bad. And they have a lot of concerns about whether Central American governments have the political will and the capacity to use effectively the money and the programs we're offering in order to make a real difference. And I think they're right to have those doubts and ask those questions. And the thing that I think is important and positive about this aid package is that it is linked to demonstrable signs of commitment by the governments of Central America to address human rights concerns and to help seriously strengthen government institutions.
We'll come back to some of the demonstrable signs of commitment that Congress is requiring. But first, we talked to Hector Silva about the current state of institutions in these countries.
When you talk about these states, you know, there's the secretaries of education, their police forces, their attorney general's offices, they're not in a modern place.
Right.
These are corrupt institutions, highly inefficient. Their agents are underpaid. So these states are failed in these regards.
We spoke with Adriana about whether or not there is political will within these governments to change, and she did point to some bright spots.
It's just a question, you know, of political will, which is, I think, is key and will be key to how effective even this aid package can be.
Do you think there is political will?
I think there are opportunities. And I think it varies, you know, country to country. I think in the case of Guatemala, I mean, a new government just took office. There are concerns that have been raised about the Jimmy Morales administration. But you have opportunities there. You have the CC. You have now a much stronger and more effective attorney general's office that has, you know, increasingly shown more levels of independence. You have some openings within the judiciary with the head of the Supreme Court also trying to show greater levels of independence. They've managed to maintain the downward trend on homicides. Obviously, it's still a huge issue. It's still one of the most violent countries in the world, but they have managed to maintain that downward trend, which I think is positive.
So Adriana mentions over the past year some big wins against the high levels of corruption in Guatemala, but also elsewhere in Central America. The most notable have come from the International Commission Against Impunity in Guatemala. She refers to it by its initials, the CICIG. This is a UN international anti-corruption body with prosecutorial powers established 7 years ago. But Honduras, too, has also seen a few corrupt elite individuals get convicted lately. And El Salvador has started investigations into some former president's alleged corruption. So some formerly untouchable people are starting to fall under the legal system. And more citizens have been pushing back on their own. You saw massive protest movements this past summer in Guatemala, right around the time the president and vice president were getting indicted for corruption. And thousands took the streets in Honduras as well over a huge graft scandal. Hector described what drove these big movements.
What you see there is a lot of young people, you know, coming from whatever, you know,
right.
The barrios, poor neighborhoods, or the national university, the private universities, political parties, yes, unions, you know, you name it, with one message. We're sick of corruption, you know. It's very simple. I mean, I work all day, you know, despite of having a gang member in the corner of my house, despite a lousy public transportation system, and despite the, you know, and the lousy salaries, I do work all day to sustain my family. So I'm willing to do this, to work here in this country, to be honest, to be a law-abiding citizen. But what I would not tolerate is you guys, politicians, stealing it from me. You know, it's not fair.
Aside from concerns about corruption, some members of Congress were worried about U.S. taxpayer money funding abusive security forces. In Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, there have been some horrifying reports of military and police carrying out attacks on the population. We talked to Jose Luis Sanchez, the editor of El Faro, a news site that has done deep investigations on this in El Salvador, about unlawful killings being committed by members of the military and police there. In El Salvador, the government has deployed to the streets over 7,000 troops and thousands more police currently engaged in a war with the gangs.
And In March of last year, they started to sound the alarms because they exceeded 400 homicides per month. The president gave a speech in April in which he highlighted that about 140 of these deaths had been carried out by the police, and he told the people not to worry about it because there are less criminals in the streets. This tacit message has constantly been in our government's discourse, saying that part of the victims are gang members, and that therefore the population shouldn't worry about the high level of homicides. The Inspector General of the Police hasn't acted in obvious cases. In July, we published in El Faro an investigation about a police massacre in San Blas with 8 victims, supposed gang members, who had been killed in March. El Salvador's human rights ombudsman said that its investigation showed strong indications of being an extrajudicial execution. However, the response of the police chief, with the backing of high levels of government, including the security ministry, was that there was no reason even to open an investigation, nor did the attorney general open an investigation. That means that the attorney general, the police, the security ministry, the whole executive branch, agree on looking the other way while this is happening.
Adriano was just in El Salvador and also found that the Salvadoran government doesn't seem to be doing much about these cases.
I don't see strong enough efforts to try to investigate these cases on the part either of the Inspector General's office, of the police, or of the authorities to try to send a message that, yes, I mean, you know, we're dealing with a very complicated security issue, but cases of torture, of abuse, of extrajudicial executions are not acceptable.
Serious issues like these, corruption, human rights abuse, political will, institutional weaknesses, are why some members of Congress are concerned about where U.S. taxpayer money is going in Central America.
I'm afraid to say that if the U.S. doesn't come with effective supervision methods as the one that are drafted in the law, in the budget law, in the appropriations bill, which, you know, for instance, allows the Secretary of State to suspend the assistance, all the tax U.S. taxpayer money will, you know, go to, I don't know, in the best of cases, will be non-effective. In the worst of cases, will end in the pockets of a corrupt official.
So as Jeff Thiel mentioned earlier, and then Hector just here, the $750 million in the bill was not a blank check. There are serious conditions attached to this assistance, about 12 of them, put in mostly by the Senate but agreed to by the House. They aim to hold these governments accountable. What are some of these conditions? Well, there's some border security ones that don't have as much to do with human rights. 25% of money in this package is held up until the State Department can certify that the Central American governments are meeting some measures to up border security and keep people in their own countries. On the more positive side, an additional 50% of funds are held up until the State Department certifies to Congress that governments are prosecuting corrupt officials and cooperating with regional human rights bodies, that they're implementing tax reforms. These countries have some of the lowest tax collection rates in the entire Western world. Strengthening customs agencies, where a lot of corruption has been seen, consulting with local governments and civil society, tackling organized crime, and supporting programs to reduce poverty, create jobs, and promote economic growth in migrant-sending communities. Until such a certification is issued, this aid money is held up.
Two of the conditions speak to some of the security force abuses we just mentioned. One commits these countries to investigate and prosecute, in civilian courts, members of militaries and police forces who have violated human rights. Another requires countries to build up professional civilian police forces and get the military out of policing. Jeff explained to us why these conditions are so important.
Police shouldn't be used to fight foreign invaders, and the military shouldn't be used to do policing. Police shouldn't be used to fight foreign invaders because they're incompetent. Military shouldn't be used to do policing because there's this tremendous temptation in Central America because of its history and every place for the military to assume political responsibilities. And the more domestic responsibilities they assume, the more attractive assuming that political responsibilities link to them. So I think it's almost always a bad idea.
We see this militaries as police trend happening all over Central America. As we noted a few minutes ago, in El Salvador, the military is a keystone of public policing. Honduras has set up a military public order police, a new branch of the armed forces that President Juan Orlando Hernandez tried, but failed, to add to the country's constitution. Guatemala has army citizen security squadrons that operate in high-crime neighborhoods. Most people who engage in the root causes debate don't see a greater military role as the way out of Central America's challenges, especially given armed forces' very troubling histories in the region. The conditions in the 2016 U.S. foreign aid law recognize that a military-heavy or hard-side approach is not the way to go. Here's Jose Luis Sanchez.
Much of this money is being invested in training and equipping police, for example, and the police right now are carrying out a crackdown. This money is evidently not reducing violence. Instead, it's feeding an escalation of violence that's involving the police. If there's not a permanent, structured state policy, and I'm talking about El Salvador, oh, this could also apply to Honduras, even though the homicide rate is down there. As long as there are no integrated policies, this money actually ends up being invested in programs that lack coherence and simply don't work.
There is growing agreement that a functioning, independent judiciary is a necessary condition to help Central America address its security challenges. The U.S. government and other international donors are backing anti-corruption bodies targeting high-level corruption and links to organized crime. The 2016 aid package included $7 million for the CICIG in Guatemala, the UN prosecutorial body. It also leaves the door open for money to go to similar initiatives in Honduras and El Salvador, something some lawmakers are pushing for. Here's Scott Hamilton speaking last April when he was the Central America director at the State Department.
With respect to CICIG in Guatemala, we are very strong supporters of it, as you know. We would very much welcome consideration by other countries of a similar entity in their societies. CICIG succeeds because it's independent. It's not susceptible to manipulation by anyone. And to the extent that Guatemala can help persuade Salvador and Honduras that these are valuable interventions, we would very much support them in doing so.
Honduras has just signed an agreement with the OAS for its own international anti-corruption body, the mission to support the fight against corruption and impunity in Honduras, known by its Spanish acronym MAXI. Here, Adriana explains its mandate.
I don't think that the MAXI is as strong as the CICIG, or the International Commission Against Impunity in Guatemala, in the sense that it does not have the independence to carry out investigations like the CICIG in Guatemala, and it doesn't have the ability to actively participate in the prosecution of cases. So in the case of the CICIG, it is able to participate as a private prosecutor when right. Guatemala is known as querellante adhesivo. The MAXI doesn't have that attribute.
So despite this, will U.S. funds be going to this commission in Honduras, and how will it start to change the country?
If it does what it says it's going to do, it would be a step forward. One of the interesting questions will be whether the State Department and the Congress fund it. Yeah. Because it's all, the Honduran government has agreed to it, but the Honduran government isn't offering any funding for it. They'll offer an office space. But their expectation is that all the funding and staffing will be international. And that means, first and foremost, the United States. And so, like I said, the legislation has language that would allow, I think, up to $5 million in funding for a commission like that. But the Congress has to evaluate this commission and decide whether it's really going to be effective. And I think our recommendation to them will be that they make an initial contribution, but that they hold off on a full commitment till they see real progress. And I think we've just had some discussions, and I hope others will have discussions about what progress would actually mean. So, for example, that in its first 6 months, the commission is fully staffed. That the curriculum of its leaders is available to the public, so people can look at it and say, "Oh, yes, this is somebody with a real commitment and a history of investigative capacity and commitment to fighting corruption." That they have enough vehicles to do their job, a whole set of basic things like that. And I think our Congress would be remiss if it didn't look for those kind of benchmarks and wait and see if that's happening before it makes a full and blank check sort of commitment.
Beyond judicial strengthening, in doing these interviews, we asked everyone about some ways to make Central America safer so people don't have to flee for their lives. Jose Luis explained the importance of international pressure, not just for an independent justice system, but for overall security.
La presión política internacional.
International political pressure forces, in a way that internal social pressure hasn't done, international pressure forces states to guarantee human rights of detainees. to guarantee that police are subject to internal controls. That's something that's hardly happened in the past year. El Salvador has absolutely relaxed its internal disciplinary controls on the police with regard to use of force cases.
Beyond institutional accountability, both Jeff and Adriana talked about what needs to be happening in neighborhoods. They talked about something called community-level violence prevention.
A community is better able to identify what the real problems of that community are and being able to figure out jointly what the best strategy or solutions, comprehensive solutions, are to addressing those needs. So, you know, the violence in one community or might not necessarily be the same as, you know, a neighboring community.
I think all the evidence, though, is that the effective response to community to gang violence in the midterm requires community organization and community response. And that in the experiments USAID has done and German GIZ have done, and in fact the government of El Salvador has done, what is clear, and this is true in the United States as well, and the National Institute for Justice will tell you this, what is clear is that bringing together community institutions, so community organizations, the local church, the school or schools, the mayor's office, and the local police together to develop a regular program to reduce community-level violence, that's the effective midterm strategy. And that strategy works because you identify the neighborhoods that are most at risk and target your resources there. You identify the kids who are most at risk. Among the kids who are active, young adults who are active gang members, you identify at the community level the people most likely to commit violent acts, and you can use police in a targeted way to deter that, and you can use churches and neighbors. Nothing is a magic solution, but I think the evidence is, all of the evidence is that organized communities that have community groups, local political institutions, and the cops all together see significant reductions in homicide.
In Jeff's view, a lot of U.S. programs are headed now in this direction.
Our USAID programs have moved in that direction. Our community-level violence prevention programs have moved in that direction, as have, the vision of the Salvadoran government, the commitment of the European Union and others. So I think on that level, at least, there's room to make real progress.
There are a lot of details to be ironed out with the 2016 aid package. We haven't seen the spending plans yet. We'll be following it closely here at WOLA this year, though. Hopefully, we left you, for now, with a good idea of what's needed for Central American countries to become places that people will feel safe staying in and where they have opportunity when they do. The solution definitely won't come in a year, nor will it come with the similar-sized aid package proposed for 2017. It will take a longer-term commitment, not just from the United States and other international donors, but from elites, politicians, and communities themselves throughout the region. That is what addressing root causes is all about.
Thanks again for listening to the WOLA podcast. Remember, you can find us online at www.wola.org, where we're posting new information and analysis every day. While you're there, please consider clicking on that Donate Now button in the upper right-hand corner. That's how you can help sustain the work that makes this podcast and so much else possible. Thanks again for listening, and bye for now.